Chapter 26. Shared Struggle. Want not, waste anyway. We in the developed world are generally not working to survive. We have more than enough of everything we need, so much so that we can actually afford to waste it. According to a 2004 study by Timothy Jones, an anthropologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson, as much as 50% of ready-to-harvest food will never be eaten. In fact, the average American household wastes 14% of food purchases, 15% of which are products that have not yet expired. Translated into dollars, the average American family is throwing out nearly $600 per year in meat, fruits, vegetables, and grain products. Simply learning to preserve or freeze more food could save families nearly $43 billion per year. The developing world also loses about the same as the United States, but not because they throw stuff out. According to the Stockholm International Water Institute, as much as 50% of post-harvest food grains will never be eaten simply because of spoilage and improper storage. The developing world loses 50% of its food supply because people aren't looking after it properly, while we, the developed world, lose 50% of our food because we throw it out unnecessarily. This is the burden of having too much. It's easy to spend or dispose of what we do not need when there is plenty more available. Our prodigal ways are not a new phenomenon. That's how our Paleolithic ancestors lived. One of the theories as to why Homo sapiens started farming was that they weren't very careful about the resources they had available to them in the first place. One could say, we've been wasting what we have since the beginning, and we only adapt when we can't afford to waste any more. These days, too many leaders of organizations seem to be wasting the goodwill of people. I wonder how long that can last until they can't afford to do it anymore. If we simply measure the amount of food or energy Americans throw out, how much money we spend wantonly, that should give us an indication of how little we actually need. And that may be our biggest challenge, the fact that, as a society, we feel no burden. Feeling a shared common burden is one of the things that brings us together. Less hardship means less of a need to cooperate, which means less oxytocin. Few of us volunteer to help people in need before the natural disaster, only after it. In this day and age, there is an abundance of food, resources, and choices. The number of products on offer at a supermarket, or the availability of something like electricity, are things our society takes for granted. This is what commoditization is. It is when a resource becomes so ubiquitous that it loses its perceived value. Computers used to be amazing special tools. Companies like Dell built huge businesses on the remarkable value of these machines. However, as supplies increased and prices came down, the products became commoditized, and with it, our appreciation for how remarkable these tools are in our lives diminished. Abundance destroys value. It is not when things come easily that we appreciate them, but when we have to work hard for them, or when they are hard to get, that those things have greater value to us. Be it a diamond deep in the ground, career success, or a relationship, it is the struggle it takes to make it work that helps give that thing its value. Our best days at work. When asked, "What was one of your best days at work?" very few of us recount the time everything went smoothly, and the big project we were working on came in on time and under budget. Considering how we work so hard to make things go well, that example should count as a pretty good day at work. But strangely, the days everything goes smoothly and as planned are not the ones we remember with fondness. For most of us, we have warmer feelings for the projects we worked on where everything seemed to go wrong. We remember how the group stayed at work until 3 a.m., ate cold pizza, and barely made the deadline. Those are the experiences we remember as some of our best days at work. It was not because of the hardship per se, but because the hardship was shared. It's not the work we remember with fondness, but the camaraderie, how the group came together to get things done. And the reason is, once again, natural. In an effort to get us to help one another during times of struggle, our bodies release oxytocin. In other words, when we share the hardship, we biologically grow closer. You may be getting sick of me saying this over and over, but our bodies are trying to incentivize us to repeat behavior in our best interest. And in hard times, what better way to protect the tribe, organization, or species than to make us feel good for helping one another? Our best days at work were the ones where we helped each other endure and overcome hardship. And if those days do not come with fun memories, it is probably because the team didn't come together and backstabbing and selfishness prevailed. When we work in a culture in which we are left to fend for ourselves, even a good day at work, from a biological perspective, is still a bad day at work. Those in the military often speak of fondness for their time deployed. It seems strange that a group living in austere conditions with real threats of danger would have fond memories of these times. They probably won't say they enjoyed it. They might even say they hated it. But a surprisingly high number will say that they were grateful for the experience. This is the result of the oxytocin we feel, knowing that we made it through thanks to the help of others. And those relationships help us manage the hardships when we come back too. Contrary to popular belief, those who deploy actually commit suicide at slightly lower rates than those who stayed back. One theory is that those who did not deploy often have a hard time coping with being alone while their team goes off to face external dangers together. In times when resources are scarce and danger is looming, we naturally come together. This is why the four major uniformed services work so well together in a combat situation, but bicker like spoiled children back at the Pentagon. In combat, when uncertainty is high and the external threats are real, they work together to increase the chances of survival and success. In contrast, back at the Pentagon, where losing huge sums of money is the biggest threat they face, the leaders of each service all too often work against one another in the name of protecting or advancing their own interests. Common are the stories in combat of a person who sacrifices themselves to help another person, regardless of uniform. Rare are the stories in the Pentagon of one service sacrificing to help another uniformed service get what they need. If our species thrives when we are forced to work together to manage through hardship, then what we need to do is redefine hardship for our modern age of abundance. We need to learn to readapt, to understand how to operate as we are designed within these complicating conditions. To the relief of many listeners, we do not need to give up our abundance and live a monk's life to do this. Our challenge is that our visions of the future are confined to our means. We need to reframe our visions to outsize the resources we have to realize them. Redefining the struggle. It is no accident that small businesses so often run innovation circles around large corporations. Though almost all large corporations today started small and innovative, they seem to lose their ability to innovate when they get big. About the only way big companies, flush with resources, seem to innovate these days is when they buy smaller companies that have the big ideas. Have none of the leaders of large corporations stopped to wonder why smaller, less resourced companies, staffed by a smaller group of people struggling together, are the ones who usually come up with all the latest innovations? Size and resources are not necessarily the advantage. Sharing a struggle for limited resources and working with people who are intent on building something out of nothing is a good formula for a small business. But recreating those conditions is extremely difficult for organizations that have already suffered together and succeeded. This is one of the reasons we find Apple such a fascinating company. It has repeated its success multiple times, from the Apple I and II to the Macintosh and the iMac, from the iPod and iTunes to the iPhone. Instead of just looking for new ways to sell old products, which is largely what most successful companies do, they invented new products and competed in new industries. We know that our species is not built for abundance, and that our internal systems can short-circuit when we're in environments of abundance. We know that we are at greater risk of succumbing to the addictive qualities of short-term dopamine-driven incentive structures in our companies if the chemicals that influence our behavior are out of balance. We also know that we won't pull together until the oxytocin and serotonin are able to flow more easily. Leaders of successful organizations, if they wish to innovate or command loyalty and love from their people, must reframe the struggles their companies face not in absolute terms, but in terms relative to their success. In other words, the dangers and opportunities that exist outside the circle of safety should be exaggerated to suit the size of the organization itself. Let me explain. A small company struggles because it does not have the resources to guarantee it will stay alive. Survival is a real concern. It is how well the people pull together to outthink their problems that often makes the difference between success and failure. Trying to buy one's way out of problems is less effective and unsustainable. A larger, more successful company, in contrast, doesn't fear for its life because it is flush with resources. Survival is not the motivator. Growth is. But we already know that growth is an abstract and non-specific destination that doesn't ignite the human spirit. What ignites the human spirit is when the leaders of our organizations offer us a reason to grow. Aiming for the quarter or the year just isn't compelling. It doesn't offer much of a struggle. That's not to say it's easy. It may or may not be. But the resources are readily available for the company to accomplish such goals or come close. To really inspire us, we need a challenge that outsizes the resources available. We need a vision of the world that does not yet exist, a reason to come to work, not just a big goal to achieve. This is what leaders of great organizations do. They frame the challenge in terms so daunting that literally no one yet knows what to do or how to solve it. Bill Gates set Microsoft on a path to put a PC on every desk. What happened to that vision? Though Microsoft may have largely achieved its goal in the developed world, the goal is still a long, long way from being accomplished. Like a small business, if a large organization can frame their challenge relative to their existing capacity, the people will figure it out. That's where innovation comes from. Sadly, due in large part to the poor leadership of Steve Ballmer, an inclination to throw money at problems and sacrifice people when necessary, the leaders of Microsoft sabotaged the very conditions required to drive the innovation they sought. Steve Jobs set out, in his words, to put a dent in the universe. More practically stated, he believed that the way for us to truly capture the full value of technology is to adapt the technology to fit the way we live our lives, instead of requiring that we adapt our lives to fit the way the technology works. This explains why intuitive interfaces and simplicity were key to helping him advance his vision. If the leaders of organizations give their people something to believe in, if they offer their people a challenge that outsizes their resources but not their intellect, the people will give everything they've got to solve the problem. And in the process, not only will they invent and advance the company, they may even change an industry or the world in the process, just as an early version of Microsoft did. But if the resources are vastly greater than the problem before us, then the abundance works against us. Though it may take small steps to make a big leap, it is the vision of the big leap and not the action of the small steps that inspires us. And only after we have committed ourselves to that vision can we look back at our lives and say to ourselves that the work we did mattered. The value of purpose. Stanley Milgram's authority and obedience experiment from the 1960s showed that those with a belief in a higher authority were much less likely to follow orders they suspected could harm others than those who did not. In every variance of the experiment, it was the volunteers who did not see the scientist as the ultimate authority who refused to go all the way. It was their adherence to a higher purpose that gave them the strength not to follow orders blindly. In the case of our businesses, neither our bosses nor our clients are the ultimate authorities over us. And in the case of public companies, nor are the shareholders or Wall Street analysts. And believe it or not, a small company does not answer ultimately to its investors either. All these authorities are Milgram's scientists in white lab coats. Authorities in the situation, perhaps, but not ultimate authorities over the decisions we make. Just as Milgram's study would have us predict, those leaders and companies with a strong sense of why a strong sense of purpose, and courage enough to stand up to the pressure of Wall Street or abstract shareholders are the ones that do better in the long term. Bob Chapman works hard to ensure his company remains profitable and continues to grow, but he sees profit as simply a means by which he can serve the people who work at Barry Waymiller. Profit, in his mind, is a fuel, not a destination. Chapman answers to a higher authority and feels a responsibility to look after the sons and daughters who are in the care of his company. Chapman has the courage to ignore those who would demand he make short-term decisions simply to make the numbers work. Jim Sinegal of Costco believed he had a greater responsibility to the people who worked for his company than to those who simply profited from their labor. A leader of Marines is taught to put the Marines in their charge before themselves. Every CEO of Southwest Airlines has known that their first responsibility is to their people. Serve them and they will serve the customer, who will ultimately drive the business and benefit the stakeholders, in that order. These remarkable leaders and all those who work in their organizations believe they serve a cause rather than an outsider with selfish motives. And that cause is always human. Everyone knows why they come to work. When a company declares that its cause is to become a global leader, or to become a household name, or to make the best products, those are selfish desires with no intended value to anyone beyond the company itself, and often not even everyone in the company. Those causes can't inspire humans, because those causes aren't causes. No one wakes up in the morning inspired to champion that. In other words, none of them is a cause bigger than the company. Human beings have thrived for 50,000 years, not because we are driven to serve ourselves, but because we are inspired to serve others. That's the value of step 12. All we need are leaders to give us a good reason to commit ourselves to each other.